You're listening to the Stable Management Podcast, where we discuss the barn management topics that you're passionate about.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Stable Management Podcast. Our goal is to bring you a real-world look into the parts of horse farm management that you love or hate most, such as stall bedding, farm equipment, and pasture maintenance. During each bi-monthly episode, we'll be joined by an expert guest who shares their experiences with and perspectives on an important stable management topic. Do you enjoy the Stable Management Podcast? Want to learn even more about horse healthcare? Get your management and industry questions answered at Ask the Horse Live, a free audio event available exclusively from thehorse.com. Each Ask the Horse Live episode focuses on a specific equine healthcare topic chosen by our editors. We gather leading veterinarians, researchers, and industry experts to tackle your toughest questions. You can also hear on-demand episodes of Ask the Horse on thehorse.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, Haley Kerstetter, and my guest today is Dr. Katrin Lowndes from the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for the introduction. Looking forward to talking all things endocrine.
Yes. So as you mentioned, we have a very important topic today that I think affects a lot of our horses and, in return, the stable managers who are working with them. So can you just briefly explain to us what PPID, EMS, and ID are and how they might differ?
Absolutely. So PPID stands for pituitary pars intermedia dysfunction, or better known in layman's terms as equine's Cushing's disease. And essentially, it's a disease of older horses, kind of teens and 20s, but can affect horses as young as 10. And it's caused by an adenoma or a benign growth of the pituitary gland. And this ends up with a loss of the dopaminergic inhibition of the pituitary gland. So you get excessive amounts of adrenocorticotropic hormone, or ACTH. And this then breaks down into alpha melanocyte stimulating hormone, or alpha MSH, and corticotropin like intermediate peptide, or CLIP. And these have effects on equine metabolism and immunomodulation. And that's what basically causes the clinical signs we are all familiar with in our PPID horses, which are our heavy, hairy coat that doesn't shed out properly, muscle atrophy, difficulty maintaining weight, PUPD, or excessive drinking and urination, and then also some recurrent health issues from the decreased immune system, such as recurrent lameness issues due to abscesses or laminitis, high rates of infections, particularly respiratory or dermatitis issues, or eye issues. And then in terms of equine metabolic syndrome, conversely to PPID, which is again a disease of older horses, equine metabolic syndrome can affect any horse. It really does not care what age your horse is. And equine metabolic syndrome is a collection of risk factors for the development of endocrinopathic laminitis. The most important of those risk factors is probably insulin dysregulation, which I'll talk a little bit more about in a minute. And then some of the other risk factors we associate with equine metabolic syndrome are fat accumulation, either as generalized obesity, or we can get the regional fat accumulation or fat pads like the cresty neck, either side of the tail head, in front of and behind the shoulder and over the ribs. And we also see in these horses hypertriglyceridemia, abnormal adipokine concentrations, and increased markers of systemic inflammation. And basically, they're all predisposed towards laminitis. And then in terms of insulin dysregulation, aside from being the main factor in equine metabolic syndrome, it can also happen in horses with PPID. And that insulin dysregulation, when we're talking about horses, we're primarily concerned about hyperinsulinemia with or without the presence of insulin resistance. And when I say hyperinsulinemia, I mean that the horse has high levels of insulin circulating within the blood. And this is the predominant cause of laminitis in these guys.
Awesome. So I think that some people might know that certain breeds or types of horses are most at risk for metabolic problems, but could you explain which breeds these are and why they're at a higher risk?
Yeah, so definitely, particularly with equine metabolic syndrome, we see a breed predisposition. We don't necessarily see a breed predisposition with PPID. Again, the main factor or type of horse is older horses for PPID. But with equine metabolic syndrome, yes, there does seem to be a genetic factor in that disease. And primarily the poster children are pony breeds, particularly what, coming from the UK and Ireland, I would refer to as our native pony breeds. So our Welsh ponies, Connemara's Highlands, Dartmoors and such. And if you think about, and obviously Shetland ponies, and if you think about where those breeds come from, for the Dartmoors, the Welsh, they're up on kind of mountains, moorlands, as poor quality grass. The Shetland Islands are notoriously barren, to the point where Shetland ponies will actually eat seaweed to get their fill their caloric needs. And then Connemara is also pretty barren as well. So these are animals that have, over generations, developed to thrive in areas that have poor quality forage and make the most of what little calories and energies is available to them. And the same can be said of some of our other breeds that are predisposed. So Arabians, again, are a desert horse, and the same goes for donkeys or desert animals. You look at your Spanish breeds, particularly come from southern Spain, where it's a little bit more arid. Mustangs are coming from, you know, you're talking plains grasses, again, not very good quality pasture. And then the other breeds that we kind of see that's happening in would be a lot of our American breeds, our American quarter horses, and then our American saddle breeds like Morgans, Saddlebreds, Tennessee Walkers, Kentucky Mountain Horses. And a lot of those, if you trace back their bloodlines, they go back to these other breeds we were talking about, our ponies, our Arabians, and our Spanish breeds. So generally, they're just not suited really to be brought and put on these lovely, lovely Chester County pastures we have locally that are predominantly dairy pastures. It's just too much energy is overwhelming their system. So that's the general thought. Some other breeds that are predisposed then would be our draft breeds, which again, they're farm animals. We would have selectively bred for animals that didn't need so much caloric upkeep and therefore were not as expensive to keep. And then the warm bloods, and again, probably due to their lineages back in draft breeds.
I can definitely relate to this because I have two miniatures at home who, luckily, yes. I have a good dry lot for them, but it's always a struggle, and I'm constantly working with my veterinarian to make sure that they're doing okay and our setup is working for them.
They, like I said, miniatures come from Shetland ponies. Shetland ponies are developed to get fat on air.
Yes, definitely. So how could owners recognize early signs of metabolic problems in their horse?
Yeah, so this is a really, really important thing because a lot of times we do find ourselves a little bit behind the eight ball because our classic pictures of these diseases are associated with their more severe presentations. So in terms of PPID, like the classic PPID horse is big, shaggy, hairy coat, generally poor condition. And that is usually a horse that's already got pretty advanced disease. Some more subtle signs you can look out for is if you've got this older horse that is having recurrent hoof abscesses. And when I say recurrent hoof abscesses, I'm not talking like once or twice a year. I'm talking once or twice a month. Or they're having repeated severe dermatitis, or they're very, very prone to corneal ulcers or have trouble healing corneal ulcers. Those might be earlier signs that you might catch a little bit earlier before they get that typical cushionoid look that might tip you off or tip your veterinarian off that you may want to screen this horse for PPID. In terms of equine metabolic syndrome, again, the things to look out for, do you have these abnormal fat deposits forming? And the thing to keep in mind is not every horse with equine metabolic syndrome is obese. Is that fat all over generalized fat? Sometimes you can get this skinny metabolic horse phenotype that they look like they're in good body condition, but they're carrying a little bit fat over their crest. They're carrying fat either side of their tail heads, or they've got abnormal kind of fats on either side of the shoulder. And then the other thing to really keep an eye on would be to look at their feet, and look particularly for presence of what we call divergent rings. And these are kind of ridges in the foot. Obviously, there's normal growth rings, but with the normal growth rings, the dorsal hoof wall should still be pretty smooth to the touch if your horse has multiple bumps going down the dorsal hoof wall or down the hoof wall. This can be an indication that they're having low level inflammation, even if you're not actually seeing any lameness associated with it. And that, but really, the most simple way to have early detection of these diseases is to do routine screening of these animals that are at high risk.
Yeah, definitely with my horses, that's something that we're starting to talk about now, especially as, the one just turned 15 this year, so she's starting to get to that age where you start thinking about it more. So it's a good reminder, I
Absolutely.
think, for our listeners to do routine screening, even if they don't see maybe those super obvious signs. I think everyone recognizes the super overweight horse or the very long
First.
hair that never sheds out, but it's a great reminder. So, could you explain the testing process then for these metabolic problems?
Absolutely. So, PPID, there's kind of two commonly used tests now for PPID that are popular at the moment. So the most simple is to do like a baseline ACTH. So that's a single blood draw. And that's to measure the circulating ACTH. That's a test we can do any time of year, and in any horse. However, it's not the most sensitive test out there. So just because your horse has a normal baseline ACTH or resting ACTH doesn't mean that they don't have PPID. If you've got these kind of, again, you're in the earlier stages of the disease, it's not quite so severe yet, they may be normal on baseline. So that's where our TRH stimulation test comes in. So that for the TRH stimulation test, there's two blood draws. First, we take a baseline sample, and then we give 1 mL of a synthetic thyrotropin-releasing hormone to stimulate the pituitary to produce ACTH. We do expect in any horse an elevation and excretion of ACTH in response to this injection. However, in horses with PPID, this response is exacerbated. So that's a more sensitive test. Or the kind of tricky thing about that test is it does we see the seasonal effect, a seasonal increase in ACTH in the fall months. And while we do have reference ranges for baseline ACTH in the fall, we do not have reliable reference ranges for the post-TRH blood in the fall. So that test we typically do not use in the fall months. And also it is not particularly reliable for monitoring a horse's response to treatment, because we do not really expect the post-TRH blood levels of ACTH to decrease in response to treatment. So really we are relying on our baseline ACTH to monitor response to treatment, which can be tricky in the horse that was diagnosed on a TRH stim, had a normal baseline. Then we're trying to use blood work to monitor response to treatment when they're normal on baseline to begin with. In terms of equine metabolic syndrome and insulin dysregulation, our still gold standard test is our oral sugar test, which is, again, we take a baseline sample for insulin, and then we give a dose of Karo syrup. And at 60 minutes and 90 minutes, ideally, after the dose of Cariserp, we see what their insulin response to that Cariserp is. Again, we've got reference ranges for both the resting and the post sugar insulin ranges. And again, because we can miss some horses on just a resting, depending on time of day, whether they've had feed or not, or how long post-feed it is. The trick with the oral sugar test is obviously 90 minutes is a long time for your veterinarian to be on your farm when they've got other calls to go see potentially, and you've got other things to do with your day as well. So it's not always very feasible out in the field. So what are some of our other options? Again, we can take a resting insulin, and if a resting insulin is elevated, woo, slam dunk, horse definitely has equine metabolic syndrome. The problem is with the resting insulin is if it's normal, it doesn't mean that it's normal all the time. Insulin is extraordinarily variable throughout the day, season, and in response to things like exercise, stress, and feed. So another option that we kind of refer to as our poor man's oral sugar test is to do like a postprandial insulin. So the idea of that is you are pulling a blood sample for insulin 2 hours after the horse has had their normal grain meal. And this gives you an idea of what their insulin is doing in response to what they're being fed, which can be really helpful in multiple different ways. One for diagnosing equine metabolic syndrome, but two, also once they've been diagnosed, for kind of making, helping to make decisions regarding changing their diet if necessary. But again, even if their postprandial is normal, it's not a guarantee that they don't have equine metabolic syndrome. It just thankfully means that what you're feeding them isn't exacerbating their equine metabolic syndrome. Some other new biomarkers we're looking at are adiponectin, which is a fat hormone that is considered a good fat hormone. So it is has insulin-sensitizing effects and is also thought to have some anti-inflammatory effects. So we definitely want high levels of that, ideally over 10. But we do find that in horses that are more prone to equine metabolic syndrome and laminitis, that adiponectin levels are often decreased. The other one we look at is leptin, which is another fat hormone, but this one is kind of considered a bad fat hormone, if you want to say it, which is a little bit more complicated than that. All these things are. But if we have elevated leptin, it's a marker of increased body fat percentage, essentially. So it doesn't necessarily, in and of itself, correlate with insulin dysregulation. It's more a better sign of like obesity. And particularly, you can have some horses that on the outside look great, but have a lot of kind of visceral fat or internal fat, and leptin can be a good marker of that. However, where it could be useful is if we take leptin in conjunction with adiponectin and look at the leptin-adiponectin ratio. This is something that's been used a bit in human medicine and has been shown to be a more sensitive marker than adiponectin alone for risk of diabetes or human metabolic syndrome. And we are seeing the same trends now in horses in terms of potential for having equine metabolic syndrome or laminitis if they've got elevated leptin adiponectin ratios.
Awesome. Yeah. So you mentioned diet briefly. Can you expand on that and tell us a little bit more about what role diet plays in preventing and managing these conditions?
Yeah, definitely. So it is very, very important when you're talking about insulin dysregulation, in terms of managing that with diet, because, well, maybe not so much managing, but making sure we're not exacerbating their insulin dysregulation with diet. In terms of, I'll start again with PPID because that's what I've been starting with the whole way through. PPID, there's not necessarily specific dietary recommendations regarding PPID. We should, of course, with any aged horse, any horse really, have a well balanced diet that we're meeting all our recommended vitamin and nutrient requirements. Most commercial feeds do this, particularly if they've got a nutritionist and a veterinarian on staff helping guide formulation of these feeds. Because we tend to see this protein loss in horses with PPID, we do want a diet that's high in good quality, highly digestible protein, particularly threonine and lysine, to help combat that muscle wastage. Most senior diets do a really good job of this. If you've got a horse with PPID that is struggling to maintain weight, it may need high calorie diet. And that's where it becomes really important in these PPID horses to identify if there is any concurrent insulin dysregulation. Because it's important to remember, not every horse that has PPID or Cushing's has insulin dysregulation as well. But a lot of them do, and they are a little bit more predisposed to it than a horse that doesn't have PPID. So making sure whether or not there is ID insulin dysregulation present is going to be really important while formulating your diet plan. Because if there is no insulin dysregulation present, then a great way of putting weight on a horse is letting them have access to pasture. But we don't necessarily want to do that in our insulin dysregulated horses. If you do have an insulin dysregulated horse, you might have to increase their calories through a different method, like adding fats instead of using a high calorie grain. Then there's some discussion whether how much of a role antioxidants and oxidative stress plays in PPID. However, the jury's very much out on this, and there's not a lot of research on whether there's any benefit to feeding antioxidants in horses with PPID. In terms of equine metabolic syndrome, the big thing is you want a diet that is low in non-structural carbohydrates, so your starches and sugars. Ideally, when we're talking non-structural carbohydrates, we talk about them in terms of percentages, and a diet that is ideally less than 10% NSC is what you're looking for, particularly hay should be less than 10% NSC. If you have to feed grain, it should be less than 10%. Ideally, definitely less than 12% non-structural carbohydrates. A quick and dirty method of calculating the non-structural carbohydrates, if it is not listed on the feed bag, is to add the percent starch and percent sugars. If this information is also not listed on the feedback, which has been a certain trend I've noticed recently, there are websites that can help you find this information. Mad Barn has a lot of resources on a lot of commercially available feeds and will list their non-structural carbohydrates. You can also lower non-structural carbohydrates in hay by soaking it for 60 minutes in cold water. It's important, if you are going to do that, that you remove the hay from the water before you feed it. Otherwise, they're just going to have this lovely sugary soup to eat along with their hay. And also, we do not recommend soaking the hay overnight, because that can lead to increased chance of mold growing on the hay. So really, we do recommend no more than 3 hours soaking. And then the other really important thing, as you've already mentioned with your ponies, they live on a dry lot. That is fantastic. The dry lot really is, in terms of limiting NSC, the ideal thing to do. However, I understand how that can be difficult if you don't have access to one. So we do recommend that you, if you don't have access to a dry lot and you are turning out on grass, that the horses should be muzzled while they're on grass. A lot of people try to time muzzling, like they'll take the muzzle off for a couple of hours, or they're like, oh, I'll just turn out overnight without the muzzle, because yes, we don't necessarily want to see our horses in muzzles all the time. Unfortunately, horses have a knack, if they're doing that kind of timed restriction or timed muzzling, that in the time the muzzle is off, they will just gorge themselves on more grass. and can often eat the same amount of grass they would in a longer time period in as short as 3, 4 hours. So that really is a no-go in terms of timed muzzling. You can time your turnout on grass with the muzzle to avoid the times of day where we have the most non-structural carbohydrates in the grass. So typically, non-structural carbohydrates in grass tend to be lowest early morning and then increase throughout the day and peak late afternoon, early evening around 5 p.m. So we would recommend if you have the option to not have the horse out on grass 24/7, that they go out in the morning. And then what becomes particularly difficult is how do we feed these skinny metabolic horses? Because, like I said, not every metabolic horse is fat. You've got this skinny metabolic phenotype where they can be either ideal body condition score or even a little bit under conditioned, and this is common in these horses that have concurrent PPID and metabolic syndrome. So how do you feed that horse? Because obviously what I've spoken about before is a lot of restriction, which is not ideal in your skinny horse. So what can you add to their diet that's safe from an NSC point of view, but can still add calories? So alfalfa and legume hays are great for this. They tend to be lower in NSC than your grass hays. But they still are pretty high calorie from protein and fat, and they're also a good source of high quality protein. Using hay cubes and bagged hay can often guarantee the NSC a little bit better than just regular hay. And often on these bags, you will see that they are less than 10% NSC. Fat supplements, so fat is a low NSC option for adding calories to the diet. So your oils, vegetable oils, bran oil, rice bran oil, and those kind of things are a great way to add fat and therefore calories into your diet. Cool calories is another kind of powder supplement if your horse isn't into a lot of oils in their feed. And then the other option to get more feed into your horse in a more metabolically safe way is to split your meals into small, frequent feedings so that you're not resulting in these kind of insulin spikes from big meals. So a 2022 paper by McConnell et al. Suggested a feeding maximum rate of 0.1 gram per kilogram of NSC. So in a 1,000-pound horse that you're feeding a 10% NSC feed to, that's a kind of 1 pound meal, and that can be given every couple of hours.
Yeah, I think that's a really good reminder for our audience. So, unfortunately, we're already coming to the end of our time today,
Oh,
but I have one more question for you.
yes.
And can you tell us what is one common misconception or mistake that people make when they're managing horses with metabolic problems?
I think I'm gonna briefly, we haven't touched on this, but levothyroxine, people use Thyroel a lot for managing metabolic horses, particularly for weight loss. It is really, really important to remember that when you're using Thyroel, that you also need to stay restricting the diet, because basically what it does is it increases metabolism. And if you increase metabolism without restricting diet, they're just going to eat more and they may actually put on weight while on Thyroel. So if you're going to use Thyroel, please also restrict their diet.
Yeah, what a good reminder. I think one of the probably most common topics that we get questions about on stable management and the horse is how to feed horses with metabolic problems. So I love that you gave us a really detailed description of that. I think that's going to help a lot of our owners.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today, but it's been great talking with you today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And thank you all for listening. Please remember to like this podcast, subscribe, leave a review, and recommend the Stable Management Podcast to a friend.